that situation, then I can deflect the prophecies of the Book of Revelations away from the inevitable fate. That is my role, and that's why I've chosen Canada to become the monarchy-based situation that I can use as a jumping-off point. I've already got control of the Secret Council 10, and the biblical prophecies won't happen as long as certain functions can work according to a mathematical formula that's laid out under long-range planning of effects and anticipating them. But on a public level, you will see eventually Canada move into a heavily dominated monarchy situation, either via Prince Charles or through maybe the Bourbon group up there in Stouffville, which is supposedly slated to go back to Stouffville, Ontario. It's supposed to go back to France, but I think they might have something strong set up here in Ontario. As long as this monarchy situation is quite top in Canada, then you know that I'm behind that and probably will be propped up eventually as King of Canada. But that will be just a means of publicly letting people understand what went on behind the scenes and a way of communicating to people the significance of the biblical prophecies. And if effects work out as I anticipate, then we can bypass the biblical inevitable fate. So I would say that study Herbert W. Armstrong to understand the meaning of the reunification of Europe and the knocking down the Berlin Wall and the waking up of the United Europe in 1992. That is a fact that I have already, shall we say, subverted. But it is not to be made public. Just like, as Tom Rich was saying, the effects of the Battle of Harvest Moon in 1977 were not really made public until 86, 87, 88, 89 via the Gorbachev's theater. The final theatrical act was the knocking down of the Berlin Wall. Now, for the 90s, is how soon will Queen Elizabeth abdicate and put Prince Charles on the throne? Actually, that is one event I would say to Tom Rich we could look for. I think we can see Prince Charles will become King Charles, or whatever they call him when he's king, within the next 18 months. Mm-hmm. All right? And then you'll know that it'll be important to keep our work here, Mike, because our pattern for the 90s will have been laid and focused around the rise of the monarchies in Europe.
Will there be a reason for that, or will it just be her time will have come and she'll have stepped down?
The reason is that, according to my formulas, my immediate ecological formulas, is that Gorbachev has pushed the ante and forced the monarchies to come to the surface at a faster pace than maybe they planned. That's why Queen Elizabeth, who knows a lot and can't tell Prince Charles everything, and she did have a private audience with Dr. Beter in the early 80s. She's aware of these matters. She sat there and caused an identity crisis for her 40-year-old son and his wife. It had nothing to do in the 80s, right? And I think that's the same dilemma for Marion Barry in Washington. When you're a mayor of a city in the West under solar government conditions, there's not much for a mayor to do. As we can see, prime ministers can't do much and presidents. So what can a mayor do? I mean, he's got to sit around there for 10 years. So I think you get some aberrated behavior on that level. Well, the aberrated behavior has been coming out of the Buckingham Palace over the last 10 years around Prince Charles and Lady Di. And if it wasn't for Gorbachev's moves under my direction, I don't think he would have seen the throne in his lifetime. Maybe not for another 10 years, but he will see it within 18 months. Mm-hmm. So Queen Elizabeth realized she has to get off and update and educate her son to what his role is, because Bob's on the move. So let's check out the CIET.
Okay,
why don't we phone them too, Mike? I think you can try them.
I'm just not, but there's not much happening, Bob. I'm a little disappointed.
The first reason I say you can't win is...
Forget it.
Suppose his wife was no good.
Good news.
I mean, really took the man through a bunch of changes. Then he's going to thank you the same way. Because he's adjusted to the idea and would like to think that all women are alike. Now, if she was one of those terrific wives, and he was the one responsible, then you got to deal with a double problem. The guilt feeling.
Well, nice music, but nothing to do with being discarnate.
It's not working. I guess it's really only a church program in name.
Yeah, I think that they're too busy listening to our show. I bet you they only get active every other week when I'm not on. They're too busy spying on us right now to see what they can talk about next week, right?
Well, The phone lines have slowed down. I'm sorry, I've had trouble getting to the phone tonight. I'm very low energy tonight, Bob, and a little despondent, as you know. So.
I know the reasons, too.
But I suppose if you want to field another phone call or two, I don't mind. We can do that. Otherwise, we can wind things up and play Dr. Beter.
Yeah, let's since the Baku oil fields are in the news right now, we should have a little 2 or 3 minute message from Dr. Beter about the significance of the Rockefellers after World War II. This is from June 1975.
After the deal with Churchill was arranged by the Rockefellers to drag the United States into World War II, Nelson Rockefeller's activities at the top of the federal government steadily accelerated. He personally lobbied through Congress an endless array of programs which were sold as necessary for national defense and security and the like, but which were actually for the purpose of draining off our national wealth into Rockefeller coffers as rapidly as possible. Lend-Lease, for example, was used, among other things, to help build up the military and economic strength of the Soviet Union as part of the price for the Rockefellers to retain their control of the vast Baku oil fields in Russia. The concessions to these had been obtained by the Rockefellers in 1926, granted to them by Stalin as repayment for the Rockefeller role in the Russian Revolution in 1917. You probably remember from your high school history book that the Russian Revolution was financed from outside Russia. What is not usually mentioned, however, is that the Rockefeller dynasty was the source of that financing. Thus, an alliance between the Russian communists and the Rockefeller Empire was forged, which has persisted down to the present day. Foreign aid, beginning with the so-called Marshall Plan and continuing with the Point 4 program and so forth, was the object of particular enthusiasm on the part of Nelson Rockefeller, who championed them in every possible form throughout the country. And no wonder. As early as December 1948, only months after the Marshall Plan got underway, the Chicago Tribune published an editorial based on Marshall Plan records which proved that the majority of foreign aid funds were cleverly channeled into the pockets of the Rockefellers through accounting devices of their multinational oil companies. But the various bills lobbied through their Congress by Nelson Rockefeller and his aides to require most foreign aid monies to go to certain Americans for overseas development purposes remained intact, and looting of foreign aid funds by the Rockefellers has never been stopped. Over the years, foreign aid has extracted mountains of money from American pockets, and it is no coincidence that the rise of American-based multinational corporations has coincided with the era of ever-expanding foreign aid. These multinationals, with their unique tax advantages, multiple citizenship, and access to foreign aid funds, among other things, were initially a product of the growing worldwide power of the Rockefeller dynasty, but have long since become a primary means by which that very power is growing by leaps and bounds.
Okay, that was Dr. Beter in audio letter number one, his very first audio letter in June 1975. I drowned out the first words a little bit, muffled them with the date. His opening words were something about basically that there was an agreement between Churchill and Nelson Rockefeller to get the United States into World War II. That was the opening words that I sort of smudged over.
Mm-hmm.
The Rockefeller dynasty then dominated from 45 till 77, till the Battle of the Harvest Moon. Do we have a call?
Yeah, we do.
Okay.
We're winding our way down to the Church of the Subgenius radio hour, and going a little over tonight.
Thanks, Mike.
If you have a question or a query, 595-1478, and be patient if you hear the phone pick up and no one's talking to you, don't be alarmed. Hi.
Turn up the radio.
Hello.
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 Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
A couple of things. The Baku oil fields, Gorbachev doesn't want them because we already proved, counter to our own assumptions, that we could let the Arabs have the oil. And when we did that, we separated ourselves from them spiritually, and they've been having a lot of violent reorganization ever since, right?
Yeah, you're saying that Gorbachev doesn't want the Baku oil fields.
Well, if he learned from Marshall McLuhan, if he learned from us, if we can learn from him, then what happens here is we had an oil crash in 1973, right?
Yeah.
But we gave the Arabs the oil.
Yeah, that's right.
And the history of the Arab development, I've just read a very interesting distorted book on them. But they...
What was the title?
Closed Circle. It's a behaviorist approach to analyzing Arab history.
Okay.
It oversimplifies them, describes them as tribal jerks, and says that every one of them pushes on the other, and if they're not busy watching someone push, they're busy pushing back, and reduces their whole history to about 5 terms of reference. It's stupid.
Is this a Harvard writer?
No, English.
British intelligence, okay.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah?
I think that I thought... Oh, you could get into that, but I don't...
Okay, let's go back to what you were saying about the oil.
It's not worth it.
See, right.
The basic thing is, the guy gives you more factual history in a couple hundred pages than you got in your life. He starts right back around the time of Napoleon and the first contacts with the Arabs and their first perception of us, right? And he shows that they've had a history of violence ever since. He just doesn't bother pointing out that that's what we've had, too. See, he tries to cast them in that role.
Yeah.
It's when B.F. Skinner examines the laboratory rat. You know, the joke is that the rat looks up at him and says to his neighbor rat, you know, isn't it funny how we can get this jack off to go back and forth across the room every time we push this button? You know? So it's like that. And what it turns out is, oh, by the way, last time Henry Kissinger came to Toronto that I noticed was 1982.
Now, was it, he spoke at in Toronto in 1987. They broadcast on CGRT yesterday as the greatest hit of their forum series. That was April 1987. So, and then he was here that last summer at the Hollinger grouping, the media grouping.
What did he talk about?
In April 87,
yeah.
He took a Rockefeller line that Gorby was on the right track, and we can be quite optimistic at what he was doing. See, Kissinger was in the interval between the Bolsheviks and the Rockefellers, and he apparently was Bolshevik control in the early 80s, but the way he was talking in April 87, he was a Rockefeller dupe.
What happened? I noticed him in 1982. He came down here on the QT.
Yeah.
And because memories of Nixon were so fresh, he gave a speech to a company called Lumonics, specializing in applications of lasers, and everybody believes that you can do anything with lasers, right? From medical technology, you can make scalpels, you can cause atomic fusion by focusing a laser beam on molecules, etc., etc., etc. Obviously, you can do something with it. But anyway, their stock improved to a point where if you'd have bought it, you could have sold it for about 40% more than, you know, it got 140 cents back on your dollar.
Yeah.
And then it kind of leveled out and behaved in an ordinary fashion. But that was the year that the market touched bottom.
Right, and that's when the Bolsheviks were ransacking the Rockefeller banking and oil empire. And I think it's interesting that Kissinger would come and speak to a laser company because that would be the particle beam apparatus the Bolsheviks were trying to set up over with their space shuttle program.
It was just before the Spar Aerospace and the Canadarm thing,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
And we needed a little bit of confidence up here. And it was just like a real mild touch as I saw it. I thought to myself, if Kissinger's going to talk to him, then everybody is probably going to buy that stock. The only thing wrong with that was it was reported in the Toronto Star, which is not exactly read by major geniuses. So I thought, well, no, that's too obvious. So I watched the stock, and it performed quite nicely. But so did the market. We got out of that. Remember the Dow was down at 700?
Yeah, see, that was because Gorby and him stopped the battle of the stopped the first strike in September 82. That's why everybody was nervous through early 82, and the Rockefeller banking group and the Bolshevik control group were just laying low in the summer of 82. and the real crisis point happened in Mexico. But in September 17, 82, when Gorby successfully, his team successfully stopped the first strike by the Bolshevik-controlled Pentagon, then the market and business could get back to having a little more optimistic view, and the market began the famous recovery. That was right after the battle of after the first strike attempt.
Well, the Iranians were alone at that time, right?
Yeah, they were Bolshevik-controlled.
And, well, you see, this gets complicated, but what it boils down to is the first point was that if we could let the Arabs, right, have the oil and make economic progress, as indeed we have, and a lot of good things have happened on a geopolitical scale, just on an ordinary level, then evidently the Russians can do the same thing. They can let the their Islamic minorities have the oil, and it won't cost them the oil. This 1910 brand of thinking, where if you haven't got a ring of steel around the oil field, you ain't got it. Now, the last people that were trying that were the Ayatollah Khomeini and Saddam Hussein in Iraq there.
Yeah.
And they looked pitiful.
Yeah.
They looked pitiful, and they looked weeping and crying and hurting and everything else. And I don't blame them, because that must have been some pretty god-awful human suffering going on down there. Now, the idea that at this point in human history we would want to imitate what we've already proved doesn't work, and Gorbachev imitate us, this is beyond belief. The Russians want to learn how to have Beatle music. They still want that, but they want more. But, I mean, I think the thing is that the Russians, if you want to look at it realistically, they have to say, you could say that we have treated the Arabs in a very inhuman way. Because if they've reacted violently to each other's dreams and made those dreams spill blood, but then perhaps they've been reacting to the violent reflections of our reflections from the Russian fact and the Russian reflection from our fact, and the violence of those power games reflected in their reality. Let's say we abandon them to it now.
Are you saying that maybe we're seeing a more further decentralization of Gorby's empire
in
Azerbaijan?
Maybe, but what I mean is, suppose, take it this way now. In southern Bulgaria, the first thing you got is violent ethnic tension. But it's reported immediately. Then the next week you're told that all 60,000 dead people in Romania was really only, I forget the exact figures, but you lower it down by a factor of six anyway. You know, they more than quadrupled what actually happened in their description.
Yeah.
Unless they're lying to us later.
Yeah.
Assume that the maturity that allowed them to tell us very promptly these true facts, which they must be true because we've got satellites and we've got overflights, and I don't think they can hide that much, then this ethnic violence in Lower Bulgaria, that goes back to the Armenians and the Turks, which started off when the Armenians fought on the Russian side in the First World War, when the Ottoman Empire jumped into it when they didn't have to, and surprised them, so on and so forth. That's been lying there untouched at a certain level of analysis in the communal mentality for 75 years. Now, it wakes up again, and it turns out that indeed 3 years ago they forbade their Turkish citizens in Bulgaria to have Turkish names. This corresponds very tightly with the paranoid delusions of Robert Bourassa who immediately decided that must be a good idea. He must have X-ray eyes. He could see past the Iron Curtain. He thought, if those stupid Bulgars... I mean, you remember the first James Bond book, On Her Majesty's Secret Service?
Yeah.
Characterized by Bulgarian assassins. You could recognize them by their stupid behavior and their poorly fitting clothes and the fact that they had... one of those, you know, those bombs that are made of a pure circle of black iron with an actual fuse sticking out a snout at the top of it. You know.
Wait a minute. Are you making a racial slur on Bulgarians? I don't.
No, I'm making a racial slur on Ian Fleming's racial slur on Bulgarians.
Oh, okay.
I'm making sort of like I'm laughing at the memory of how he caricatured our, you know, our oversimplified cartoon understanding
yeah.
of people, I guess. No, I mean, I'm enjoying it, but I hope it's not slurring. But the thing is, that's the point. The Bulgarians are hidden behind the Iron Curtain, behind the great bloody forest of Central Europe, if you want to go back to, you know, 3,000-4,000 years B.C., right? Who could see through that forest? And they put up an Iron Curtain instead, that's fine. Bourassa was able to see through it. He thought, if they're going to forbid their Turkish neighbors to have Turkish names, I'd better forbid these Anglos that, you know, to put their names in front of their stores.
Well, do you know the McClellan point that, you know, tribal passions are a necessary consequence of electric media?
This book about the Arabs is very heart-wearing to read because it says that tribal behavior is completely cynical, completely violent, and that there's no developed human future to be found by surrendering to the forces of tribalism. This is a hard lesson. Because it means that if all the people in the world fall back on their tribal identities, it's not going to work. It's like too scary.
Yeah, I want to. I understand you're well read. There's a new article in Toronto Life magazine. Did you see the cover story about the baby boom blues?
Didn't notice. What did they say?
It's by somebody named Wendy Dennis, and it's the nostalgia of someone in her 40s, a member of the 60s generation, radical left generation, nostalgia for the tribal dream that she thought was the motivating collective dream of the 60s revolution.
Oh, yeah.
And if you read the article, you see it's a whole inventory of effects of living the electric autonomous life of being a discarnate entity with all kinds of electric media around you and fragmenting you from all tribal and family obligations. Yet this person sees the pain she feels from being discarnate in the rearview mirror of a return and nostalgia for some kind of tribal activity. And I think your point is true, that we cannot have tribal activity on a real constitutive basis, a real, you know...
That's right. Not
under these kind of electric discarnate conditions, where we're all autonomous and suffer solitude.
Well, what the great European civilization is the last good... We can't see back 3,000-4,000 years. It's too bad. But, you know, the people that were around the time of Stonehenge, just after that in England, that monolithic monument, I read somewhere that they were shepherds and that the early kings of Egypt and the early kings of the Bible, King David, were shepherd kings and so on and so forth. And I'm just, I can't make much sense of that, but I'm wondering what...
Well, let me tell you this. You just brought up a point that relates to the pattern I laid out where the emperor has no clothes, technique of suspended judgment, rule men through their passions, not over their passions, and there's no one at the bureaucratic switchboard. All that goes into the idea that the modern oligarchs orchestrate the bias of every culture now. In other words, the bias of our time, the bias of the new emperor is his awareness of the bias of each culture and able to orchestrate them. And your point there...
I guess I slipped off my point because I just realized there was a tangent there that I didn't quite reach for, but what we have is the...
Well, what I was going to say was the shepherds, okay? The fact is the oligarchs now are retrieving the shepherds. They shepherd the media. They should... If you think of people on the world's global theater stage, which we now call the solar theater stage, which is the credit card, using mixed corporate media to enhance or anesthetize their passions, that grouping, that organized mixed media with people becoming software, hardware becoming software, people becoming hardware, that interplay and interfusion and interpenetration is the sheep that the oligarch shepherds. And the shepherd sits there, the oligarchic secret council 10 grouping that I'm part of, at 22,000 miles above the earth, we are shepherding the media. So your interest in the shepherd image is very relevant to our time.
Well, it's interesting because it's so deeply buried in the Judeo-Christian myth, which is also the myth of Islam. They go back to the same God. And if they can call Christ the Lamb of God, you see what I mean?
Yep.
If David was a shepherd king, so on and so forth, it may not be well understood. This gets your Garner Ted Armstrong or his father.
Yeah.
And I wish I could have a couple hours of that to listen to just for fun. The energy that guy used to put out. But the thing is, what he says is very true. If the words say such, you know, and thus and so, then you take it literally like that, because you can read the King James Bible and you have to look up the words in a dictionary. But it doesn't hurt you, because you can only meditate on a paragraph or a sentence or a prayer at a time. Maybe the first... I've never been able to meditate on more than 100 or 200 words out of the Bible. It's always been enough to keep me going for a long time. Even a sentence will do. A turn of phrase. And we all know this.
That's because it's aphoristic. You know, it's an aphorism.
It's aphoristic, but what its value is the fact that it's there. Do you see, if you change it and change it and change it and rewrite it and rewrite it and rewrite it, it's no longer a genuine antiquity.
Well, you don't need to rewrite it, because all those other levels are implied in the aphorism. You play with it in your meditations and contemplations. That's the participatory nature of the aphorism. I mean, you can take it literally, and then you shape and reshape it in your personal responses. But you don't have to take, you know, you have to change it. It's a medium.
That's what happens when you benefit from it.
Yeah.
But it's not what you do with it. What you do with it is you attend to it. It's just there.
Okay, caller, we have another call. Now, listen, can you call me back after the show and give me the list of the science fiction books you gave me 2 weeks ago? I lost them.
Yeah.
And some other callers have requested them.
Yeah, right.
If it's possible?
Yeah.
Okay, appreciate your input. Definitely call back and continue this, all right?
Well, yeah, because I think the Russians have to be, how should I put it? They can't abandon their ethnic Muslims to brutality and war, but they've got to avoid walking all over them with the Kaiser's boots. You know what I mean?
Right. We're
going to
see some fine media ecology going on there with Gorbachev at the helm.
They better be careful.
Thanks a lot.
Okay. Thanks, Colin. All right. Okay, we'll go right to another call, if that's all right, Bob.
No problem, Mike.
Okay, still rolling along. You're listening to CKLN 88.1, the Church of the Subgenius Show.
With CIUT in the background?
Yeah.
All right. Hello.
Hello, I just thought I'd round up this Club 22 gathering.
Oh, yeah, see, this is a friend of Tom Rich. Right, yeah, do you ever want your name mentioned? Do you mind that?
No, I don't mind that.
Yeah, this is Mr. Kidney. Played Lee Harvey Oswald in 1983, and he's an old friend of Tom Rich.
So I just thought
Did
I'd
you catch
up.
Tom's stuff?
Hmm?
Did you hear Tom?
Yeah, we've been talking.
Oh, okay.
Tom's getting, by the way, Tom's latest input is he's going to be flying soon.
Good, yeah, he's getting his license.
He's going to Dallas to pick up his...
literally or figuratively?
Nearer, my God, to the machine.
But you mean that literally or figuratively?
Yeah, literally, Tom will be flying.
His attempt to approach solar government perspective.
He's trying to single-handedly wake up, pull Bush's military economy out of the fucking gutter. I just thought, for that last caller, I thought maybe if he read the Gnostic texts, you would perceive the dream sequences in the Last Temptation of Christ to be real.
But you mean Scorsese's movie?
Yeah.
Yeah, that is a Gnostic text.
Yeah, that was the Gnostic.
Kazantzakis was a Gnostic, and he took the text from Kazantzakis, right?
Kazantzakis, yeah.
Yeah, well, that is a Gnostic movie. But I have talked to this caller we just had off the air a couple weeks ago, and this guy is well-versed in every discipline in the world.
Yeah,
he's well-versed in the Gnostic stuff, too.
Yes, he does. He sounds that way.
So you're saying he should check it out. I'm pretty sure he has checked it out. So once we know he's checked it out, what would you say about it?
Well, I think it's just to help alleviate the great pain. I mean, first of all, we have problems on the planet, and then Club 22 attempts to decipher them. And I think there are more pragmatic ways of going about it. And I think reading the...
wait a minute, is that a slur? There are more pragmatic ways than Club 22 offers?
Well, I think... Let's go back to the beginning of this program.
Yeah.
Where we were... I think I missed the very beginning, but I came in when you were just discussing that you'd caught the 22 date on the document in the FAA report.
Right, the Helsinki warning.
The Helsinki warning, and I at that point I immediately thought, well, if we're going to perform a public service here, that the people that belong to the families of the victims of Flight 103 should phone up Sherman Skolnick's number, you know.
Well, that's what I was implying, is that there's this other, I don't know if I finished that thought, there's two groups of families, and they focused on, that's right, I didn't finish that, they focused on the family that advocates a Libyan kind of retaliation to the terrorist grouping that did it,
right.
Once they prove it. I think the other family they didn't focus on is the one, and Skolnick has told me that he knows about this other grouping that's interested in his theory, that it was a battle between the pro-Bush and the anti-Bush faction
right
after the election. Yeah,
well,
and they didn't feature them on that documentary.
Yeah,
the other family grouping.
Well, they brought up the fact that the actual bags that are now under suspicion were actually either carried on or switched by two CIA agents who were flying on the plane.
Yeah.
But, you know, the discrepancy there is that Skolnick's saying that there were 50 CIA agents on the plane.
Yeah, and see, I think that that would be the function of the Helsinki warning, was to get a lot of people in the State Department to get off the plane so that the secret CIA guys who wanted to be on, the anti-Bush faction, then had seats available for
them. Which was implied in the fact that some people were bumped, you know.
Yeah, and people were bumped, and then the question is, did they make a big mistake? But it is, as Skolnick pointed out, not the CIA protocol to get on a plane with a bunch of other agents, so maybe they thought that would be a cover or something if they did it.
There's so you are questions. Saying that Skolnick has been in touch with that group?
Yeah, he talked to me about a month ago, and just offhand, I remember him saying that he talked about that group. He said the families were interested in his work. That means they must be the other group. I didn't know there were two groups till last night.
Yeah, you get that impression during that program.
Yeah, they didn't feature the other group.
No,
and, of
not
course,
as much.
Yeah, and the other group is knee-jerk guys and one who believe the terrorist myth.
Yeah, I think that group was represented by the guy who was saying, I guess my daughter just wasn't important enough.
Yeah. Which he should realize under electric conditions, as I said, under electric conditions 2 weeks ago, you can be both a Roman Catholic and a pagan, a highbrow and a lowbrow, but you will not last electrically. The pinks, the Americans, the Canadians, got to wake up that they do not exist anymore.
Right.
They do not exist under electric conditions. And to start crying later when you get beat up or destroyed is a level of asleep, being unaware, that is not pardonable by such kind of outrage that he exhibited. You know, they're not justified. They don't want to know what's really going on. And that irks me. You know what I mean? They don't want to really know how far gone it is, how they have gone into captivity and lost their bodies. Nobody will deal with it. It's a hard fact to deal with. But you will not get any response in your outrage when you find that you're personally affected by the mixed media monster that's just rolling over everybody.
The great snake god.
Yeah, the beast. So, this is what Mae Brussels used to say, right? She used to say she had no sympathy with these people who got upset once they were affected, but had no interest in the situation before that. And so these guys are always fighting a rear guard action. It's sad. What did you think? Did you identify with those people, Mike? I mean, did you feel sorry for them, other than you normally would? But didn't you think they're a little late?
Well, I mean, that's why I made that comment about Bush. I thought it was really unusual that he would say, you know, we will, if it's a case of terrorism, we will seek out the terrorists and we will destroy them. It just seemed ironic, I think, coming from him, that he was
right, and they bought it.
Yeah.
And remember, they said that Bush said, I will sit here for another 80 minutes, even though it's a 20-minute meeting, until we understand each other. I think it was a little authoritarian the way he said, we understand each other. I mean, he sat there until they agreed to his program.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what he means by giving them extra time. He wanted to control them because he's on a hot seat in this situation, if it's true what Skolnick is saying. I mean, he blew up he was treasonous. He blew up, if it's true, another faction of the CIA that was out to get his faction. That's the most outrageous thing a president has ever done. Of course, this will not be looked into. That's why this knowledge is obsolete. And that's why when they do put it on front line, it's just titillating. The news will never tell you anything of consequence because the news is obsolete.
Mm-hmm.
It's totally obsolete. I mean, I think we should not listen to the news. You should not watch it. You should not read the newspaper as a political action. What do you think of that, Mr. Kidney? Would you agree to that?
I'm reaching for a quote here.
Yeah, but what would do you read the newspapers?
Yes, I do read the newspapers. Unfortunately, I do.
Well, you understand.
And I actually wanted to know what the Sunday report was that Skolnick was talking about, what the date of that actual report was.
That was November 12th.
Okay. That's for future.
Because it was the 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th. Yeah, it was Sunday the 12th. The Toronto Star broke the story.
Right.
Okay, but look, you know, as you're using the radio, just as we're using CKLN, any electric environment, as we use it, it's undermining us. In the sense of you have nostalgia for your human community or for your personal psychological well-being in
right.
the old sense, you know every day, just like Dylan said 10 years ago, when you get up in the morning and cut your toenails, you're killing yourself. That's a simplified form. That's all he was capable of the larger fact that when you turn on the electric environment, you use the telephone, you're dead. And that's a fact. And Gorby and them know this. No, they don't know it. That's what the revolution in the Eastern Europe is going to realize, is that all their democratic and tribal ideals are going to be nil compared to what they have to deal with on the global theater scale, which they already realize is on the reports, you know.
Well, that's the implied, that's corruption, right? They use the media in order to gain the audience's trust, the public's trust, in order to gain money.
Right.
And
it's self-defeating because they will not be able to offer the solutions they propose to the audience to get themselves into some kind of bureaucratic power, and then they will have to deal with the vengeance of the public, which will then be hijacked by more leaders and bureaucrats who will then offer their sort of controlled ideologies at the state level or bureaucratic control level. You know what I mean? The wheel of control. So there is nobody at the switchboard. The more we realize that, the more free we can get. In other words, we can really improvise our own destiny right now. The more you understand that.
Glory be to Bob here.
That's all you can say, right? I mean, really, Ken, you are totally free, Mr. Kitty, to do whatever. You can be a stockbroker, for God's sakes. Be a stockbroker. Be you know.
I live that vicariously through Mr. Rich.
Yeah. Write a letter to Norman Snyder at the Toronto Life and tell him not to be associated with Wendy Dennis for her somnambulistic article in the Toronto Life magazine complaining about a situation. You read the story. She's sitting there, spends every other time when she's not having an anecdote watching her television, using her remote control, and she's wondering why she feels depressed. I mean, it's a disease, and it could be used, once we improvise with media ecological formulas, we can use electric environment to really have ecstatic, erogenous, you know, interplay.
Become contrapreneurs.
Yeah, contrapreneurs. Good one. But the thing is, when are we going to face up to it? I mean, I'm here on this show. I'm only advocating turning it off. But it takes a long time to get the point across, right?
And you believe that in your heart.
Yeah. I'm not saying the electric media are bad. It's just that the context of them as a new ground dealing with the old ground of the hardware heritage the world has is not going to work. They're incompatible. And this was McLuhan's point, and it's a valid point that is not understood by Northrop Frye. He was on TVO's imprint today being interviewed by Paul Robert Williams or Paul William Robert, whatever it is, all right? And all that Norrie could talk about was the abstract notion of myth. He doesn't know that myth is a figure-ground relationship. The myth of the Bible are the stories. That's the figures. The content, the ground is the alphabet. If you don't include the technology you're using in understanding myth, then you're just leading into a Jungian and Freudian, Aristotelian visual bias, which gets into archetypal somnambulism, an archetypal which is figure without ground. The breakthrough of the rhetorical new trivium of Marshall McLuhan was to understand the figure-ground relationship. In other words, everything we're doing right now has to take in the fact we're using the radio medium, and we're using the telephone, and it's related to an environment that's inside a satellite environment. All right? If you're aware of that, then that's the myth. Bob's a myth. It's a figure-ground relationship.
But you're also, to not take the name of Jung in vain, you are performing a therapeutic duty here.
And not
you're immersing yourself, you know, into your audience.
Yeah, but not as an end.
Hmm?
Not as an end, as a means.
As a means, but it's also, it's therapeutic. I mean, it's a two-way therapy. I mean, it's an open dialogue.
Yeah, I grant it's the best slap.
And there's an expression going on, and someone's emoting on one end, and someone's feeling on the other, you know?
Yeah, no, that's okay, but we have that every day on talk shows. Mm-hmm. It's just that our show is the best because we point out the hidden ground of what we're doing.
I wouldn't deny that for a moment.
Yeah, and the thing is, we're willing to give up our show once everybody agrees that that's what the message is. You know, and we have a media fast.
Mm-hmm.
And then once we have the media fast, then we bring the media back on. But in that sense, it would have to have me in control mm-hmm. and the church to keep it honest so that we could turn it off again.
But I would advocate and accentuate the point that we must participate, you know.
That's
we must actualize, even though we are fiction,
yeah.
we must participate in order to recreate, you know.
That's the happy paradox.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not a contradiction. It's a lively parallel operation. So, again, I'm aware of what I don't say as I'm saying one thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm including what I don't say, which is what you just said, you know. And
right.
I'm aware of both points of view, if you want to simplify it. And so that's our dilemma. I'm blowing both horns of my dilemma here and your dilemma. So that keeps life interesting and slack-filled if you understand the sparkling dance of being and mimed by the arts. And I include under arts every artifact made by man, from snowshoes to Robert De Niro's latest movie.
Oh, God. What about the
You're in that, aren't you? Are you in that movie?
Have you heard about
it? Are you in that movie? Are you in that?
Forget that movie.
You're in that movie, right?
David Mamet is a misogynist pig, which I believe Sheila Gossett called you not too long ago.
Oh, yeah, have you talked
on the air?
Yeah, yeah, she
did
called.
Did she say that on the air, Bob?
That someone was a pig?
Oh, my God.
I didn't say that. I mean, no. I don't know
she
if she
did.
We did. I don't remember. I checked the archives. I don't remember. Do you remember her saying that, Mike?
No.
She was quite hostile, but, you know.
Well, listen, if you hook up De Niro and that club and the Scorsese club and the David Mamet club and the boys' club that exists in the United States in the form of the old Hollywood iconography.
Yeah, Nicholson.
And they're desperately going around like crazy kids on a partridge shoot trying to maintain their... You know, the boys play at play on everyone else's time, you know, exploiting everyone else's money.
That's right.
In order to hoik up their play, you know.
They're bigger oligarchs than George Bush. That's the real political problem.
Well, they're more successful than George Bush.
No. Bush is successful. He's going to have a second term. He'll be successful in his
term. I think that Hollywood will outlast the administration and the political body of the United States. I think Hollywood... having been the commercial firm for them in the first place to recreate themselves, I think they are more actually going to be the last things that you will see submerged after the flotsam and jetsam.
All right, what you mean by Hollywood is the new mixed corporate media software, satellite TV,
I mean,
cable.
Tom Cruise, you know, I mean...
Who? Tom Cruise.
I mean Tom Cruise, and I mean, you know...
Well, no, that only happened in North America. Entertainment is the bias need for content in North American media. This was pointed out by McLuhan long ago. They don't have as much entertainment in the other cultures. But you're right that there's a merging going on where the American environment will become universal. But at the same time, you're going to have incredible tribal reactions to this stuff. I mean, right now CNN is having a big vogue around the world, but as Tom Richards pointed out, CNN is going to have to probably eventually move out of the various countries they're in around the world because they will not accept American entertainment. It's even beginning in Europe. So Jack will become running to us, Mr. Kidney.
Mm-hmm.
They'll come running to us for jobs. And, you know, I don't know if we'll give them any. Because you're right, this is the message of speaking parts. Adam, what's his name? Adam Bagoyan?
Egan. Ego Yen.
Ego Yen, yeah. Yen for ego. Well, the thing is he's dealing with the problem of image addiction. He doesn't understand the ground of the situation, but several callers have noticed that he must be listening to my show and got a head start on their movie projects by listening and understanding little they do.
He felt very, very embarrassed standing beside Sonny Bono. I thought that was...
Yeah, but the point is that these kids are aware of the image addiction, but they know that's their generational problem in the 80s going into the 90s. Image being not just something visual, but the whole sensory matrix offered under a video image, which is all the senses. All senses.
Right. While you were probably getting busy to come down to the show tonight, the Red Cross was busy defending itself over the point that it had known about the Holocaust in 1942. And didn't release the information because they, quote, wanted to remain neutral.
Where was that on?
On a PBS program called Vital Signs something like that.
Right, yeah.
And that era also got hooked up again with the latest Jessica Lange feature, which is called Music Box, in which her father-in-law, who was a corporate lawyer in Chicago, was having lunch with Klaus Barbie. And... That movie's very interesting, yeah.
That's the old Mabrussel Nazi dilemma.
Yep. Yeah. It was all there.
And so you see, some of the holy offices have been hiked up in certain content levels, but done in a pink way. And you see, with speaking parts and sexualizing videotape, you see, attempts to deal with the McLuhan holy office. All the holy offices are becoming pretty well known in the popular form, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which points to my consolidation, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
reports to me. In other words, I will be hoiked up as a figure for the, by the Secret Council of Ten when we deal with the monarchies. But will you be with me when I do that? And would you, will you understand me when I tell everything? Will you protect me when I violate the Secret Council of Ten mandate?
Will you protect me?
Will Barbara... Yeah, good point. Would I protect you after you protected me? will Barbara Frum protect me?
Well, as Barbara Frum would say, thank you for being with us. Who is us, I'd like to know?
That's
the U.S.?
Yeah, you know what the USA stands for now? United States of Ambiguity. That's what it is. It's an ambiguous, discarnate image that we're involved in. This is a fact. I mean, even chaos physics is using these percepts to hoik up their concepts. There's, it's such a hidden ground to everything that's done in the world today, if you understand McLuhan, that, you know, you could be a Bob. You could be. Just requires a little homework.
Well, I hope they get Kretchen in there.
Why?
I think it's about time that there's, you know, a French-Canadian who can't speak English properly in power instead of the other way around, which is what it's been for years.
See, that's a good pattern. In other words, the Trudeau thing will have flipped.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm.
Well, so, yeah, it's sort of like the Diefenbaker thing's flipped. You know, a man with character.
Yeah. So you're going to go work in another movie?
I don't know. I'm being choosy, Bob.
You can be right now.
Yeah, I'm being really choosy. I'm doing a lot of reading, Bob.
Yeah, but yeah, I bet you haven't dared gone to the library and read LaRouche's Campaigners. That's a real challenge. You know, nobody will do that. I tell it every time.
Are they in the library?
Yeah, at the Bloor and Young Reference Library.
You're kidding.
In
okay.
The social studies section.
All right.
Floor 3.
All right.
They put it in the back stacks, ask for the Campaigner volumes 1973-1980. I haven't found one Torontonian person. I've been hyping that source of information for 3 years, and nobody has gone there.
Really? So they put them in about 3 years ago?
No, they've been in there since the 73.
Oh, yeah.
And
okay.
I was there a few years ago and checked it out, but I've got all that stuff personally, but
yes.
Anybody can go read it. You want to see. I mean, why is Lynn LaRouche in jail now? I mean, Mr. Secord isn't going to jail.
Oh, he's got parole.
Yeah, and Ollie North is in jail. And who's in jail is the real artist of...